Hi. Good morning, everybody. I'm Jill Campbell. I'm the Group General Manager, Investor Relations for ANZ. Welcome to everyone joining us here in Sydney this morning and at the ANZ Centre, as well as those joining us on the phone and over the web for the presentation of the ANZ full year 2016 financial results. CEO Shayne Elliott and CFO Michelle Jablko will present for around 35 minutes, after which we'll move to Q&A. I'll remind you about the procedure for Q&A just before we cross to that part of the proceedings. Ahead of that, though, welcome to any media joining us today. We'd ask that you hold any questions, though, until the media conference later this afternoon. And with that, I'll hand over firstly to Shayne.
Thank you. Thanks, Jill. For those of you who haven't been counting, today is my 307th day as ANZ's Chief Executive. And I count the days because it reminds me how fast time passes and it keeps us focused on execution. Literally, every day counts. And I say that because we recognize that the current outlook for banking is dominated by headwinds. And to be frank, we have to act with more urgency than others because of our historical business mix. Some of those headwinds are cyclical, like more subdued credit growth, low interest rates, and the turning credit cycle, but some are structural, like the impact of new technology and changing customer expectations, the cost of additional capital and compliance, and of course, changing community expectations. Every day counts because I want us to be ahead of the game and performing well, both in the eyes of our customers and our shareholders. And that requires execution at pace. We've made a good start. A lot has been done to reset our strategy, to mobilize people around what needs to be done, and to increase the pace of execution. But there remains more to do. I'm confident that we have the right team in place, that we understand the challenge, and that we've already established some very positive momentum. Our headline result has been heavily impacted by proactive decisions to reshape and reposition the business for a stronger future. These are difficult decisions, but ones that are required to ensure we are successful in the new environment. The financial outcomes of these decisions are collectively referred to as specified items, and two-thirds by value were reported in May at the first half result, with the market CVA adjustment and some additional restructuring charges announced separately last week. Consistent with our commitment to clarity, all of these items are accounted for above the line. Executive remuneration has been impacted as a result, and I want to assure you that no one received a free kick from any of these items. We are not calling out these specified items to suggest that we're not accountable for them or that shareholders should ignore them. We manage the whole business, and we are accountable for every dollar and every decision. Calling them out increases transparency and makes it easier to see through the impact of these large decisions to the performance of our core business. Other than the impairment of our investment in AmBank, I'm confident that each of these decisions will deliver a more streamlined, more productive, and more accountable organization. The second half headline result is much stronger than the first, with cash profit up 12% and earnings per share up 11%. Headline return on equity also improved in the half, and returns for the full year are comfortably above our cost of capital, even after absorbing the impact of specified items. A second half dividend of 80 cents per share is therefore appropriate. Adjusting for the impact of those specified items, this represents a payout ratio of 67%, aligned with our previously stated objective to bring our payout ratio within the 60%-65% range over time. While the sale of our retail and wealth business in five Asian markets announced earlier this week has no impact on the FY16 results, it will have an impact in FY17, and Michelle will take you through that in detail. This transaction is consistent with our strategy to simplify our business and focus only on those areas where we have long-term competitive advantage. DBS will inherit a good business, and they are a capable and experienced operator, so it's a good outcome for us and for our Asian customers. There will be those that will claim that this is evidence that ANZ is exiting Asia. That is not the case. We're committed to our presence in Asia, but this transaction allows us to focus our resources, capital, technology, and talent on an Asian business where we have a sustainable advantage: institutional banking. Looking through the specified items, our result, our core businesses, if you will, the result there is the outcome of four key factors. First, consistently strong performance in retail and commercial businesses in Australia and New Zealand. Second, the progress made to reshape our institutional business by refining our customer base and improving capital efficiency by changing the composition of risk-weighted assets. Third, the early benefits of our work to reset our cost trajectory while still investing in better customer outcomes and a stronger risk and control framework. And lastly, the change in the credit cycle, particularly in the second quarter when we saw a step up in credit costs. However, the last two quarters have seen a levelling out. In the second half, and despite significant and deliberate reduction in interest earning assets and institutional, revenue grew 1%, bringing the full year growth to 3%. Net interest margins fell 1 basis point half on half, but were stable, excluding the impact of our markets business. Full-time equivalent staff fell over 7% for the year and 5% in the second half. Combined with other initiatives, this reduced costs by 0.4% half on half and held our cost growth to below 1% for the year. Excluding the impact of specified, earnings were down $32 million, or less than 1% in the half, and ROE held stable at 12.2%, demonstrating that we've been able to time our capital and cost actions fairly well. Having said that, I want to assure you that we are focused on making the right decisions for long-term value creation rather than trying to manage quarterly results. We will not shy away from taking tough decisions, and we know we must act with pace, particularly on costs, to offset the impacts of reshaping our institutional portfolio. At the half year, we shared with you our four strategic priorities, and these have not changed. And while emphasis between the four will evolve over time, each of them remains critically important. As an executive team, our focus is on getting things done. A year ago, I presented my plan to the board based on three phases of development. These phases overlap somewhat, and today we're in the middle of phase one and at the beginning of phase two. Phase one is about rebalancing and increasing focus, removing distractions and non-core businesses, reducing off-strategy customers, eliminating non-essential processes, and making it clear to all of our people our plan for success. Asset disposals and the targeted reductions in risk-weighted assets are part of this phase, and they will help make us a leaner, more focused organisation. So too are the decisions and charges taken regarding restructuring. In order to drive execution at pace and get our teams focused on what needed to be done, it was useful to take the cost of restructuring as a specific charge in 2016. But that does not mean we expect to use such specific charges regularly, although there may be transactions where it's appropriate. We will, however, continue to simplify the business, and that will come at a cost. But going forward, it is our intention to take restructuring charges in the normal course of business, booked as and when incurred. In terms of getting things done, I think we've made a decent start. If there's any frustration, it's just about how quickly we can move on what is a large agenda. But we are executing against a clear plan, and phase one will continue at least until the end of next calendar year. Phase two is about resetting our operating model, and it's already started with changes to our organisational structure, increasing the pace of decision-making, and embedding productivity and capital efficiency as the way we do stuff around here. The creation of our digital banking team and the restructuring of our operations team are good examples, as is the adoption of higher thresholds for software capitalisation, which is also driving more cost accountability and changing the way our executives think. The benefits of phase two will have long-lasting impact, and I'm confident that some benefits are already emerging, and these decisions are partly what is driving the change in our FTE and cost trajectory, and making it easier to get to market first with new services like Apple Pay and Android Pay. However, we are reshaping a large organisation and embedding new ways of operating across many business units and geographies. Doing it properly and making it sustainable will take time. Therefore, phase two will be a key focus until calendar 2018. Importantly, though, phase three is really when we get into the positive cycle of cleaner, leaner, sustainable growth, which will start to be visible before the end of 2017 calendar year. By then, we will have made more progress on non-core asset sales, focused our resources on where we can win, improved core productivity by changing our absolute cost trajectory, and be making sustainable competitive gains. As I mentioned, we've made a good start. In particular, first, we've reset the strategy and clarified where we can win. Second, we've reshaped the executive team. In fact, the only member of my team who has exactly the same job and responsibilities as last year is our Chief Risk Officer, Nigel Williams. Every other team member is either new to the company, like Miley Carnegie and Michelle Jabko, promoted from within, like Farhan Faruqi and Fred Olson, have significantly changed roles, like Mark Whelan and myself, or has expanded their responsibilities, like David Hisco and Graham Hodges. Third, we made a start on rebalancing the business mix organically, with a significant change in the composition of the institutional balance sheet and high-quality growth in retail and commercial, but there's still more to do. Fourth, we made progress on reshaping the group, finalising some asset sales and announcing others. Five, we reshaped our workforce to be fit for a lower growth, more agile, more focused future. Six, we changed our cost trajectory with strategic and tactical initiatives that delivered our best underlying cost result in 16 years. Seventh, we've implemented a different way of running the company with greater accountability and clearer decision making. And finally, and importantly, we're changing what we do and how we do things to more quickly and more clearly respond to the changing expectations of customers and the community. While getting all of this done, we have, of course, remained focused on managing and growing our core businesses. This has been a period of significant change, and I must acknowledge the commitment and customer focus of our people throughout. Our retail and commercial businesses in Australia and New Zealand continue to perform strongly, both on a relative and absolute basis. The economic environment, particularly the strong growth in house prices in both markets and stagnation in household incomes in some areas, has meant we've adopted a more cautious approach to growth. In Australia, we remain a relatively small player with only 16% market share, so we will always be growth-oriented, but not at any cost. Our current view is that growing at or about system is right for both Australia and New Zealand. In a highly competitive market, growing its system and doing so responsibly takes significant effort and management. We are, however, also balancing this with greater focus on process improvement and innovation. This will generate a simpler, faster, lower cost operational capacity while lowering operating risk and improving the customer experience at the same time. And our new digital focus is critical to this objective. And look, I know my focus today is talking about reshaping our business, but I just want to spend a minute talking about mobile wallets and the significant advance we've made as a result of our willingness to step out from our peer group and listen to our customers. And I'm really excited about this and where it can lead. We remain the only major bank to fully embrace mobile wallets in Australia and New Zealand. It was 198 days ago when we launched Apple Pay in Australia, followed soon after by Android Pay and recently Apple Pay in New Zealand. Since then, over 5 million transactions have been completed using our wallet offerings. And importantly, it has helped drive Australian customer acquisition to an all-time quarterly high, with a significant conversion of dormant customers into active transactors in the period also. September was our best month to date in terms of cards activated on wallets, with the release of new phones in the market also driving activity. Early experience shows that mobile wallets appeal disproportionately to high-income, young professionals, and that we are already witnessing a higher propensity of them to acquire other products at ANZ. And look, we recognise that in itself, this will not materially change the group, but it is a strong signal of our intention to think differently and act quickly to respond to customer demand. In institutional, the reshaping of the business continues at a responsible pace. The benefits are already emerging, with profit before provisions improving almost 6% half on half, driven by a strong performance on cost, much of it the result of the restructuring decisions and charges we took in the first half. Refining our target market and the resulting fall in lending assets has driven a $21 billion fall in credit risk-weighted assets for the year, with almost half of that coming in the second half. That did, of course, impact revenue. But importantly, margins, excluding the impact of markets, improved by a further 4 basis points in the second half, bringing the full-year expansion to 13.5,
This is a good indicator that the right decisions are being made about our portfolio composition. Our focus on reshaping institutional will not change, but we would expect the rate of balance sheet reduction in the next 2 years to be about half that of 2016. And look, while it's easy to focus on the reduction in institutional assets, we continue to grow our high customer impact, high return businesses like cash management and foreign exchange. And that is also contributing to better returns from the business. Managing change is always challenging, but it's pleasing to see that our customers continue to rank us as number one in terms of relationship quality in both Australia and New Zealand, and with the quality of our relationship managers in Asia ranked the highest of any foreign bank in the region. Now, as Winston Churchill once said, no matter how beautiful the strategy, it pays to look at the results once in a while. So it's worth reminding ourselves why we're doing this and whether we're making sufficient progress. Our objective is to build a better balanced, simpler, higher return business that delivers better outcomes to customers and shareholders. And key to that was rebalancing our business portfolio, specifically increasing the proportion of capital allocated to retail and commercial and reducing the allocation to institutional. And a low growth environment makes this far more challenging, as we cannot simply grow our way out of the problem. In 1 year, however, our portfolio has started to shift in the right direction. Yes, some of this was due to an increase in risk weighting for retail mortgages in Australia, as APRA begins to implement its changes after the FSI. But most of it relates to the meaningful reshaping of our institutional book, which today consumes 6% less capital in absolute terms than it did a year ago. So we've made a good start, but still plenty to do. I showed you the slide at the half, and the key external drivers that we see remain intact, with 2 points worth noting. First, we feel a little more confident that the credit cycle is stabilising rather than continuing to deteriorate, and we therefore expect provision charges to remain broadly the same as a percentage of gross lending assets next year. And second, we should have broadened our definition of increased regulatory scrutiny to include increased community expectations. And the reason I'm repeating this slide is to remind ourselves that we are running the business cautiously and with a conservative risk appetite. There's a lot to be positive about in the terms of the economy in the region, but equally there are enough signs to suggest that now is not the time to aggressively target growth. That has ramifications for where we focus and how we set internal expectations. And one of those key areas of focus is capital generation. As you can see, we've made significant progress improving organic capital generation in the year, and it was even stronger in the second half. The key contributors have been significant change in the trajectory of institutional risk-weighted asset consumption and the improvement in profitability from better cost management, and we expect both trends to continue. In addition, we have more levers available than our peers to manage capital, and the actions taken in 2016 should give you confidence that we can and we will use them. The focus of my team is clear. We will continue to build our retail and commercial businesses in Australia and New Zealand, but more cautiously than in the past few years, with more focus on digitisation and improving the cost trajectory. We will continue to reshape institutional, and you should expect continued momentum on that front in terms of both balance sheet and cost. And we will continue to focus on releasing capital from non-core asset sales. Clearly, one of the most important decisions we will make will be regarding the future of our wealth business. At the half year, we announced our intentions for our online broking business, formerly known as E-Trade, which forms part of the wealth division, and that process is well underway. We also announced that we would be conducting a strategic review of the rest of the wealth business, and that review is now complete. The team conducted a thorough review of what we do, how we perform, where the risks and opportunities are, and what the operating landscape will likely be. It was a useful exercise, and while it covers a lot of detail, at a very high level it confirmed much of what we suspected. First, that we have a good business that is actually very well managed and in many aspects industry leading. Second, our business mix within wealth is very different to our peers, with a much higher reliance on life insurance than superannuation and investments. Third, the industry is undergoing significant change due to regulation and changing customer behaviours. This will require focus and investment, which may be better managed in an alternative structure. And finally, that the key source of any competitive advantage for ANZ will come from how we engage with our customers. That is, from distribution and not from manufacturing. We are therefore exploring possible options that will maintain strong outcomes for customers. Those options include the possible sale of the life insurance, advice, superannuation and investments manufacturing businesses in Australia. This is a large business with significant market share, strong underlying performance and high market value. Any decisions we make will need to be thoughtful with regard to how we create value for our customers over the long term, so it's not simple. We will keep the market updated as we progress during the year, but I would not expect to make any update prior to the half-year result. With respect to New Zealand, our wealth business and market position is different again, and our strategy there will be considered separately later next year. Given the strategic importance of these wealth decisions and our commitment to remain in the distribution part of the business, I've asked Alexis George, the MD of Wealth Australia, to permanently join my executive committee. It's hopefully clear to everybody that we are focused on execution. Execution in terms of rebalancing our portfolio, but also running our core business as well. We have a plan, and it will deliver a simpler, better balanced business with stronger and more stable returns. I'll now pass over to Michelle to take you through the financials in a little more detail.
Thanks, Shane, and good morning. We've been working hard this year to become simpler, better capitalised, and more efficient. I believe that today's results demonstrate we are making good progress on this, in particular by rebalancing the portfolio, and that we are moving at pace. Today I'll focus my comments on four key areas. The first is the detail of specified items that have impacted cash profit by a little over $1 billion. Then I will move to the progress we have made in reshaping our portfolio away from lower returning assets to higher returning ones. The third is how operating performance was driven by stable margins and improved productivity, but impacted by one-offs and elevated provisions. Finally, I will take you through how rebalancing the portfolio has driven capital generation. As you can see on this slide, cash profit for the year was $5.9 billion, down 18%. In our earnings release, we called out a number of specified items that have impacted the result this year. These have all been taken above the line and are all included in cash profit. Importantly, all of these items have been taken into account in executive compensation. We have separately identified them only so that you can compare this year more easily to prior periods and also make meaningful comparisons half on half. This slide shows that the total profit impact of specified items this year was a little over $1 billion. Around half of this relates to the decision we took in the first half to change the application of the bank's capitalised software policy. Next is the $201 million we took for restructuring expenses. We are reshaping the workforce and driving productivity by eliminating roles to reduce complexity and duplication. I will talk about this in more detail later. We also told you on 28 October that we would take a charge of $168 million for derivative credit valuation adjustments, or CVA. If I turn to the next slide, I'll take you through this in a bit more detail. The CVA adjustment is a refinement in methodology to put ANZ among the leaders of global best practice. The revised methodology is based on more sophisticated modelling and market-implied inputs. It is therefore more reflective of derivative pricing at a point in time. The change is an evolution of our existing practice. The CVA adjustment on cash profit is $168 million. Of this, $25 million relates to movements in this financial year. The remainder relates to a one-off adjustment for prior periods to mark to market the current derivative portfolio. Other specified items were outlined in the first half, and so I won't repeat them. But this slide will briefly remind you of the impact of the changes to the application of our software capitalisation policy. The change is not an impairment. It has three effects. It accelerates amortisation and thereby reduces the capitalised software balance, and conversely increases OPEX. Importantly, as Shane said, it also increases transparency and accountability within the business. Here you can see three rows of data that step through the mechanics. In the first half, we lifted our capitalisation threshold and therefore accelerated the amortisation of $556 million of capitalised software. This resulted in a full-year amortisation saving of $183 million for software that would otherwise have been amortised this year. The capitalised software balance decreased by 24% as a result. On the other side, we increased OPEX by $370 million. Without the change in policy, this amount would have been capitalised. Coming into 2017, given the rebase, this delineation will stop appearing, and the comparison going forward will be to the $370 million of higher OPEX, less the $183 million of accelerated amortisation. In other words, to an increased baseline of around $190 million on a net basis. Moving now to how we have rebalanced the portfolio during the year. We think about the group as a portfolio of businesses. We have done a lot of work to reshape that portfolio to drive better returns. In a few minutes, I'll take you through how this reshaping is beginning to have a positive impact on key metrics. You can see on the chart on the left that as at 30 September, credit risk-weighted assets were $352 billion, which is an increase of $2 billion from the same time last year. In grey, we show that $26 billion of this was due to a change in the mortgage risk weight floor required by APRA and which came into effect for each of the major banks on 1 July this year. If you look through this regulatory change, credit risk-weighted assets were $24 billion lower than the same time last year. This has enhanced our capital position. Here you can see what drove the reduction. As you can see, it was largely driven by reduced CRWA in the institutional business of around $21 billion, as well as the sale of Asanda Dealer Finance. This was offset by growth in other higher returning businesses of around $8 billion. The reduction in CRWA was more pronounced in the second half. This is because growth in the Australian business slowed, while reductions in institutional continued. In the first half, as you saw, much of the reduction in RWA came through reductions in the trade portfolio. As you can see in the table on this slide, we've been able to continue momentum in the second half by reducing our lending portfolio. Most of the reductions came through the international business. You can see on the right-hand side that margins have improved as a result. We are continuing to work on improving the quality of RWA. However, the rate of absolute reduction in the institutional business will slow. It will be managed over the next couple of years, with reductions on average likely to be around half of that achieved this year. As mentioned before, cash profit was down 18% year on year. A large part of this was due to investment in the future through restructuring charges as well as other one-off specified items. As you can see in the table in the top right corner of this slide, if we adjust for these one-off impacts, pro forma cash profit declined 2.5% for the full year. Profit before provisions grew by 6%, but this was offset by increased provision charges. You can also see that pro forma income grew by 3.5% over the year. This was the case even though lending assets grew by only 1%. Expense growth was less than 1%. While you can't see it on the slide, it is worth pointing out that if restructuring charges are included, pro forma expenses increased by 3.5% year on year. It was really a story of two halves. As you can see at the bottom of the slide, income growth was slower in the second half as our discipline on margins and a more cautious approach impacted volumes. However, costs remained well managed. Costs were down half on half as the benefits of restructuring actions taken in the middle and second half of the year started to flow through. The credit provision charge, which included the impact of the Oswald settlement, remained elevated with an annual loss rate at 34 basis points, although there was a change in the composition of provisions through the year that I will talk about shortly. Australia and New Zealand account for around 80% of group earnings. both performed well again in 2016. The performance in Australia was a mix of strong volume growth in the first half, underpinned by home loans. This was balanced with lower volume growth in the second half. For the full year, income in Australia increased 9%, or $760 million, on the back of a 7% increase in lending growth, 6% deposit growth, and relatively stable margins, and we contained expenses. In New Zealand, profit increased by 1%, or around 3% on a pro forma basis, with 3% income growth and good cost management, partially offset by higher provision charges. As you can see towards the bottom of the slide, the rebalancing of the institutional business has been carefully managed. Non-markets revenue was down about 6%, even though, as I mentioned earlier, lending CRWA was down $21 billion, or 12%. Excluding global markets, margins in the institutional business improved by 13 basis points year on year. Expenses were well contained, and in the second half, expenses were down by 6% as we saw the benefits of restructuring initiatives begin to emerge. Group NIM was down slightly from the end of the first half. Excluding markets, group NIM was actually up 1.1 basis points. Continued pressure on funding costs, including deposits, was offset by improved margins in a number of portfolios, including home loans, corporate and commercial, and Asian trade. In the second half, the Australian business managed margins well in the face of higher funding and deposit costs and industry-wide discounting in home lending. In the second half, Australian margins declined 1.8 basis points, as margin management in home loans did not fully offset higher wholesale and deposit funding costs. As a result of the portfolio rebalance, full-year institutional margins, excluding markets, improved for the first time since 2010. Higher margins in lending, trade and deposits during the period, along with a lower reliance on wholesale funding, offset increased funding costs. You can see on this slide that the trends in sales and trading income over the past several years have been relatively stable, particularly over the last three halves. Markets income was impacted in the first half due to significantly lower balance sheet revenue. In the second half, markets income was impacted by the $237 million CVA methodology adjustment that I spoke about a short while ago. If you exclude this, market income in the second half was up $113 million. We are comfortable with the markets business being around this size at about $2 billion of revenue and with over 80% of the contribution being from customer sales and trading. Investments in systems in markets are beginning to provide us with greater capacity to manage capital allocation and improve returns and productivity. Cost management has been a significant focus in 2016 and has been strong across the group. Absolute expense reductions occurred in a number of areas, but in particular in personnel costs. We reduced senior management by 12% across the group. This was even more pronounced in the institutional business, where we reduced senior management numbers by 16%. This, together with a rebasing of discretionary spending, greater efficiency in project delivery, and reduced duplication, particularly in institutional and back office functions, will continue to give us benefits in the coming year. We reduced full-time equivalent staff by around 3,600 people, or 7%. As outlined earlier, our profit includes a restructuring charge of $278 million before tax. Of this, $166 million was used in 2016, mostly in the second half. The remaining $112 million will be used on planned actions in 2017. Around half of the total reduction in FTE was due to elimination of roles for which we used the restructuring spend. It is important to understand how we think about the restructuring charge. We took restructuring provisions for roles that have been or are being eliminated and will not be re-established. We are very focused on getting the benefits of this quickly, and they are starting to come through. The actions we took in 2016 resulted in savings of about $100 million. As we took these steps throughout the year rather than at the start, the savings would be approximately twice that on an annualised basis. We expect a similar outcome in relation to the remaining $112 million to be used in 2017. We will see around $100 million of additional benefits in 2017 and double that on an annualised basis. Most of this relates to further simplification in the institutional business, the corporate centre and middle and back offices in Australia. These initiatives will help drive step change improvements in the cost base, although, as you'd expect, they will be somewhat offset by other inflationary pressures. The total provisions charge for the year was $1.96 billion. Almost all of this was due to IP charges. The key contributor to the IP increase in the second half was the Oswald settlement. If you exclude this, provisions would have declined slightly, as it contributed 3 basis points to the annual loss rate of 34 basis points. Institutional IP charges increased by $96 million in the second half, of which $147 million was due to the Oswald settlement. Increased provisions in Australia largely related to delinquencies in Queensland and Western Australia, impacting mortgages, personal loans and small and regional business banking. The CP charge was small, as the portfolio rebalance as well as lower lending volumes in Australia offset increases in risk migration. The other way of looking at this is even though CRWA fell by $24 billion, CP to CRWA coverage increased by around 3 basis points, which is equivalent to around $100 million of additional CP coverage. ANZ reported a CET1 ratio for 30 September of 9.6%, or 14.5% on an internationally comparable basis, which comfortably places us in the top quartile of global peers. We delivered 106 basis points of organic capital generation. This compares to a second half average over the last 4 years of 73 basis points and is due largely to the actions taken to reshape the institutional balance sheet during the half. Combined with actions we took in the first half to rebase the group's dividend, this has allowed ANZ to largely absorb the regulatory impact of the increase to the mortgage risk weight floor that was effective as of 1 July. It is worth noting that ANZ completed the unwind of the last of its non-recourse debt in its wealth subsidiaries in the first half. Also, the 30 September 2016 capital outcome does not include any benefit from the sale of Asia retail assets announced on Monday. In August, we told you that we had submitted our new mortgage risk weight model to APRA for approval. Following this approval, we expect that the risk weight applied to Australian mortgages will be greater than 25% within the 25 to 30% range. As of today, we still do not know the exact increase. Finally, I would just like to make some comments on the sale of our Asian retail assets. This transaction remains subject to regulatory approvals and has no impact on the 2016 financial year. As we said on Monday, the impact of the transaction will come through over the next 18 months. DBS will be acquiring assets and liabilities as at completion and will pay a premium of $110 million as well as the book value of fixed assets. ANZ currently holds around $1 billion of capital against these businesses. We expect to release 15 to 20 basis points of capital through the transaction. As you know, there will be a net impact to the P&L of $265 million, which will be a bit higher in the first half of financial year 17 and offset in subsequent periods. The sale comprised 5 individual transactions. Revenue, direct expenses and provisions will go with each of the businesses on completion over the next 18 months. Indirect costs will roll off more slowly, with a large amount gone over the next 2 to 3 years. $110 million of transaction and separation costs covered by the premium will be used in this regard. As I said at the start, I think these results show that we are making really good progress. Now let me hand back to Shane to close.
Thank you. Look, as I think back over the past 307 days, I think we've made a decent start in a tough environment. The change in the business mix, largely driven by Mark, Farhan and the rest of the institutional team, has really been a highlight, as has the entire team's ability to change our cost trajectory so materially. The environment, particularly political and regulatory, has been more difficult than we had expected, but not materially changing our strategy or intent. Our focus for this year will be getting more things done. First, delivering the benefits of decisions taken in 2016, particularly from those restructuring charges we've already booked. Second, further reshaping of our portfolio, including the decisions on our Australian wealth business. Third, further reductions in the institutional risk-weighted assets, although the rate of decline will inevitably slow to about half the pace of last year. Continued strengthening of our core franchises in Australia and New Zealand. And finally, delivering benefits from our focus on digital, particularly from streamlined, lower-cost processes that improve the customer experience. I'm excited about the blend of experience and capability on my team. I'm also very pleased with the engagement of our people in what is for many a challenging and difficult period of change. They have on the whole embraced the need for that change, and they share our desire to build a better bank for customers and shareholders. In today's climate, it may be naive or self-serving of me to say that I believe in our people, but I do. In the past year, I have visited more than 70 of our branches, sat in ANZ business centres and processing centres, listened to customer calls in the call centres, and met literally thousands of our people across seven countries. And each time, I get asked thoughtful and challenging questions, all focused on how we can do a better job for our customers. While it's undoubtedly true that we don't always get it right, a good company works hard to minimise mistakes, owns up when things go wrong, makes sure it never happens again, and puts things right for customers as quickly and fairly as possible. By that measure, I agree that we have work to do, but I'm confident that we have the right team to deliver. So thank you, and now we'll pass over to Jill to manage questions.
Okay. Despite the fact that I know you're more than familiar with this, I'm going to bore you with it anyway. So microphone will come to you. If you could announce yourself so that people on the web and the phone can hear you. We'll go to the floor first and then go to the phone and so forth. And with that, if we go to Craig, please.
Thanks. Craig Williams from Citi. The strength of your Australian division has held you in good stead this year. Pre-provision profit growth was 12% year-on-year, but sort of slowed to 2% half-on-half or 4% annualised. So how much of this slowdown is the market, slowing volumes, increased discounting competition? And how much is organisational as you implement such a large degree of restructuring and the dislocation that comes with this? And with respect to the New South Wales growth strategy for that business, it's an obvious one for the medium term, given your size, but how attractive is this path in the near term as the two largest New South Wales banks have got more aggressive as competitors?
So I'll get Fred to answer that in a second, but just in terms of where the growth's come from, it's a good observation. I mean, I don't believe that any of the slowdown in the second half is due to any of the organisational changes that we've made, per se. I believe it's really, we have changed our risk appetite. We've accepted that this is the time to be more cautious about growth from a risk perspective. And so we've seen some pretty aggressive pricing out in the marketplace, and we've taken a view and we've been really clear with Fred and the team that it's okay to just step back a little bit from aggressive growth for now. So I think mostly it's to do with that rather than the outcome of any particular change we've made organisationally. But Fred, do you want to talk about the New South Wales strategy? Because we're still very committed to growth here. But
Yeah, absolutely. So and there's a couple of things I'll point to. In this year, we have refurbished the most branches in any state we've done in New South Wales, and we've opened more new branches, more than 25 in total. We've also put on roughly more than 200 staff, predominantly frontline bankers here in New South Wales. And what we're seeing as a consequence is that we are growing above the national average in New South Wales across all our product lines and all our segments, and we expect that to continue in FY17 too.
It's worth adding also that the organisational changes in Australia were in the sort of middle back office. They weren't in the front line at all.
Craig, if you can just pass it to John.
John Mott from UBS. About a month ago, you were down in Canberra in front of the parliamentary inquiry, and credit cards were a big issue there. And you said that you had capacity to lower credit card interest rates, and then you were asked and you said you'd take leadership on this. So I wanted to get some numbers around this. If you look at the Australian net interest income for the year, $8.2 billion, how much do you expect that to be impacted over the next 12 months as you take leadership on credit card interest rates?
So what we're going to do on... It's a good question, and I did say those things. What we're going to do on cards, first of all, is remind our customers in the marketplace that we actually already offer low-rate cards. In fact, I don't think we've done a very good job of really making it clear. We have low-fee cards, we have low-rate cards, and then we have higher rate cards that come with all sorts of benefits in terms of insurance and air miles in particular. And so we've got to make that very clear. If people want a low rate, it's available actually, and there are rates in the low teens. So that's one. Two, we have looked with Fred and team at whether some of the rates that we're charging on some of those products are appropriate. In particular, there was concern around the rate that was charged on cash advances. So that's under review right now. And we expect to be making some changes and announcements about our card business and our market offering towards the end of this year. In terms of the actual impact, the total cards portfolio revenues, total revenues is more in the circa of $1 billion. So any decisions there would be relatively minor in the scheme of things, Jonathan.
John, if you pass to Victor, and we can just keep going around in a circle.
Thank you. Thank you, Jill. So I was hoping to ask two questions, one on costs and one on credit quality. On costs, you've given, Michelle, you've provided some numbers around the expectations for FY17. And from what I understand, you're sort of saying that the restructuring charge should deliver around 200 mil of incremental cost saves. Last week, we heard NAB looking to deliver around 200 mil of cost saves without actually taking any restructuring charges. So I'd be interested in your observations as to kind of, I understand that those restructuring charges are going to lead to that 200 mil of cost saves, but maybe you can talk, what are you planning to do in excess of that? Because presumably 200 mil is not probably enough. And the second point on BDD is we've obviously this year been impacted by legal settlement. You talked about that institutional bank BDDs are actually trending sort of to a more normal level. I understand there are some concerns around other parts of the portfolio, but flat BDD charge in FY17 seems like a pretty high number. So is that just your view on the economy here? You expect things to deteriorate? Or do you still see that there are some differences with ANZ's credit quality relative to peers? Because I would have thought, you know, if institutional is improving, you should actually at least relative to peers start to see convergence in that charge.
So I'll start on the cost one and then I can get Michelle to answer some more questions on that. So we're not going to give you a target number for kind of cost savings that not relating to the restructuring charges. You're right. Not all savings that we look at in terms of cost have to have a charge associated with them. It's largely to do with when we're talking about people, unfortunately. But you're right. I mean, part of the dividend and part of the streamlining, the whole purpose of restructuring the organisation and rethinking it and simplifying what we do and where we do it is to naturally drive out a lot of cost. And so we have seen, I mean, it's important to note that about half of the FTE reduction came from just managing attrition. So it didn't come at any cost. We would expect more of that. We would expect more management of our discretionary costs. You know, a more streamlined organisation doing less things in less places, naturally costs, whether it's about the marketing spend we have, whether it's around travel costs, whether any of those things will be removed. But the big opportunity for us is really about process improvement. And, you know, we talk about digitisation. Well, what's that? That's just about streamlining processes, making them simpler and cheaper to do. They don't come at a restructuring cost. There might be costs of investing in technology, but we think that we can absorb that cost within our current envelope of about that $1 billion that we spend on new projects every year. We're just going to put more and more of that towards taking out cost. And in terms of the, do you want anything on the cost piece?
The only other thing I'd add, so if you go to the fact that about half of the FTE that came out was restructuring in 16 and half was attrition. Of the half that was attrition, some of that was actually managing roles out of the organisation as well. So some of that, you know, some of the attrition roles will come back, but others are out for good. And on top of that, you have other natural attrition as well. Offsetting that, as I said in my remarks, there is some natural inflation that happens in the business as well. So they, you've got to take all of those factors into account.
And Ted,
So with 7% reduction in headcount, what proportion is relating to restructuring?
About half.
So the other half is not included.
Now you've got to be a little bit careful here without. You know, not all FTE, they're not all equal, right, in terms of, you know, some are very senior, some are very junior, they have different costs, right? So the natural attrition generally comes in the lower cost people, right, because that's generally where we have high turnover anyway, and the restructuring is generally targeted towards the more senior and more expensive people. So it's not totally one for one. In terms of your credit costs, look, I think that's it's a fair observation. I guess what we're signalling here is more that when we look, and most of it's to do in Australia and New Zealand, but even in Asia, what we're seeing is we see the credit environment as being reasonably stable. There is a little bit of stress in places. We see that from in Australia in terms of underemployment, so not so much unemployment, but people, household incomes stagnating and falling. That's putting people under a little bit of stress. That's feeding through into small business. It's feeding through into the corporate sector. So there's some signals out there that says things are going to be perhaps a little bit worse. So we should be cautious. But having said that, you're also right to say that as we restructure institutional, in theory, we are reducing the inventory, if you will, of our potential credit problems in institutional. That's also true. We're just saying that over the next year, we're taking a conservative view that says we would expect the loss rate to be in those low 30 basis points, right?
Yeah, the only other thing I'd add on that is the sale of Retail Asia doesn't start to complete until the second half of the year. And so the provisions associated with that, probably more of those go in 2018. Than 2017.
And the reason to be, you know, there's some reason to be, I guess, optimistic on the actual charge, and that is, you know, as we shrink the balance sheet, and that is obviously what's happening, if you apply that loss rate in the low 30s, the actual number, there's a possibility that the actual provision number will be lower. But the purpose of us saying that we think it'll be, you know, broadly the same was to say that's how we're running the company. We're running the company not assuming we're going to get a free kick on the provisions line. We're running it cautiously.
So would it be fair to assume that the relativity between you and peers should shrink?
It should. I mean, part of the benefit of, you know, if you go back to our strategy of simplifying the business and rebalancing, it's a recognition that we, you know, we're kind of overweight institutional, if you will. And with that comes risk and volatility. And part of the benefit of the rebalancing is to, you know, to be more in line. Well, one of the outcomes, we will look more in line with our peers. It's not our intention necessarily to look more like peers, but that will be an outcome, yes.
Jared.
Martin from Credit Suisse. Shane, we've heard consistently over the last 5 years that the partnerships are non-core. We're selling them. I think we've sold PT Panin half a dozen times at least in that period of time. We've heard it again today, but it sounds that there's a bit more motivation from yourself. We've observed that in the last 6 months you've managed to actually divest the Asian retail and wealth business, which is a blue brand, effectively.
Yes.
So it appears that it's much easier to divest something that is fully your own than a partnership. And then the implication is that to get rid of the partnerships, do you actually have to take a material write-down? And how closer we are to any of those in the next 6 months?
So, look, all of those observations are fair. Clearly, it's easier to sell something that you're in full control of. And the nature of partnerships is that we have partners. And we, all four of those banks, the four stakes that we're talking about, operate in, you know, tough regulatory environments where there's a lot of political issues to deal with in terms of, you know, ultimately getting a sale approved. Our intention hasn't changed. You know, I don't think it's got more intense or more, you know, we're more keen to sell. We've always been keen to do that. They're just complex. I think it is not about price, actually, Jared. It's not that, you know, we're not willing to take losses and that's why we're reluctant. We don't need to take losses. I think, you know, with the exception of AmBank, which we've impaired and clearly got some issues on that one, the others are, well, even AmBank, they are attractive propositions for the right buyers. It's not about a lack of buying. It's not about price. It is just complex situations and getting through the approvals of both our partners have to approve who's buying and obviously government and regulators in each of those markets. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Andrew.
Thanks. Andrew Lyons from Goldman Sachs. Just a question on your ROE. A big part of the portfolio rebalancing you're undertaking is about improving the returns of the business. You've done about $20 billion of runoff in the institutional business this year, reasonably evenly balanced in the first and the second half. That's expected to slow going forward. I'm just wondering, are you disappointed with the ROE outcomes you've seen to date just at the group level, to the extent that if we look at the half-on-half ROEs, it's sort of been stuck at around sort of in the low 12s? Can you just maybe talk about some of the timing issues around when we should see ROE start to improve?
That's a really good question. And again, it is the purpose of doing this. It is. We want to increase our allocation to our retail and commercial business while sort of maintaining their returns. And we want to shrink our allocation to institutional while improving the returns in institutional. The returns on institutional are improving. They are coming through. What you're seeing at a group level is we had a coincidence of time here. At the same time, we're able to reduce institutional pretty materially. We had to increase the risk weighting in our mortgage book in Australia because of the new risk floor. So, you know, the good news is we're able to absorb all of that. So that's acted as a drag on returns. At the same time, we're getting the benefits in institutional. I'm really confident that the returns will improve from the rebalancing. You know, the total extra amount of regulatory cap we got from the risk weighting in Australian retail is about the same. It's actually more than the CRWA reduction we had in institutional. It's in the mid-20s.
Group level, that capital was already held in the business last year.
True. So, but I'm just saying, look, am I disappointed? No. You know, we're doing the right thing. I'm actually really pleased with the progress we've made in institutional. It's not easy to reduce at that pace and do it responsibly and still. And I think the outcome on, look at margins, look at the revenue reduction, it's pretty good. We will get the ROE benefit in time. I'm confident of that.
Richard, and then we'll go to Andrew Triggs.
Good morning, Richard Wiles, Morgan Stanley. I have a couple of questions. One relates to costs and the other relates to capital. On the costs, your pro forma results looked really good, up 1% year on year and 0.5% half on half, but obviously they exclude the specified items. The amortisation cost net seems to be up $190 million. The restructuring was up $280 million. I understand from your comments today that they'll be included in normal operating costs next year. And then within your pro forma costs, licensing and outsourcing was up $150 in the year. Professional fees were up $100. So if we take all those together, there's $600 million of additional costs that you've baked into the business this year. Can you give us some indication of whether that restructuring charge goes to zero next year, given that you've still got $112 million in the kitty to use? Does that net amortisation impact start to fade in future years? And is the uplift in outsourcing and professional fees, is that one-off because you've been restructuring this year, or is that going to stay at that elevated level?
So why don't I take some of those? So just to go through them again. So on the restructuring charge, I'm just trying to make sure I've got your question right, Richard.
Well, the restructuring charge was $280 this year. You said next year it won't be a specified item, so there's going to be some charges in there.
Yeah.
Does that come back towards zero or
what we're saying there is that we're going to continue to restructure the business. We're going to continue to streamline and make it simpler. That will mean that there will be some costs associated with that. It won't be $280 million, right? I don't think it's going to be in that ballpark. But it's still going to be a reasonable number. The real question, and I think it, you know, in many ways, if we could spend the $280, that might be a good thing. It's really, are we getting sufficient benefit from it? And what Michelle showed there, I think that on average, the sort of benefit we're getting from the restructuring charges, they're paying for themselves in the year they're taken, and we're kind of getting a double, two times payback permanently. But I don't think that they're going to be of that magnitude going forward, and they will be in our normal business. The other thing to note in there was that when you talk about professional fees and the consulting fees, outsourcing, et cetera, some of those are actually the sorts of things that actually would have been capitalised in the past. Right. So one of the other things we changed in the software, we also changed what we capitalise. We've changed not just the threshold, we've been much tougher on
what we allow to be capitalised. So it's really, really now about, you know, the software, not just all the professional fees that go with it. So we take it in the OPEX line.
Yeah, so I might talk about what's happened in the technology costs, because it is a bit, to follow it through, given some of the changes we made, it requires a bit of explanation. So when we changed the software policy, the bulk of that cost was really felt in TSR and the technology part of the business. If I look at what did we actually spend on technology this year in real dollars, we had there's investments and there's BAU technology. Of our investments, we invested about the same, a little bit less than the year before, and the reason it was a little bit less was we got a bit more efficient in our project delivery, but roughly around the same. In terms of BAU, the cost on a BAU sense was up only about $15 million. So we took some people out. We did variabilise the workforce a bit, so some of that was replaced with outsourcing. But in a net sense, it was up around $15 million. Some of that $15 million probably... there were a couple of one-off savings we got. It was small in the context of things. So that number might go up a little bit next year, but that's how I'd sort of think about technology. And then in terms of the software, the 190, if I look at our what we're investing this coming year in 17 relative to 16, you know, we're talking pretty similar numbers.
Yep. Can I ask on capital?
Sure.
Yep. Sure.
It's been a lot of focus on mortgages, but the Basel proposals, which hopefully will be finalised in coming months, suggests that for risk weighting on specialised lending should be 120%. The risk weighting on corporate exposures should be 60%, and that banks shouldn't be allowed to use internal models. Now, in coming up with your 14%, 14.5% international ratio, it looks like you're using risk weightings of about 80% on specialised lending and about 35 or 40 on corporate loans. So if those proposals come in and they're not watered down, you're going to have a very big increase in your risk weightings on two quite large categories. Do you expect it to be watered down, or do you think that there's a risk that your capital requirements for specialised lending and corporate loans go up quite materially?
So I'm not sure whether, Nigel, you want to, in terms of the views on that one, that's a... I mean, it's kind of a work in progress here. It's a tough one to know exactly.
Yeah, I think it's a work in progress. There's a lot of speculation as to what it may or may not be. Clearly, there will be changes in the corporate loans, and you would expect also the corporate loan pricing to adjust accordingly as well, because I don't see that, you know, capital is going to be deployed, additional capital is going to be deployed into those areas. I think, you know, the indications are that it will be watered down, but I think the speculation is... I think it's too dangerous to speculate on just how much that'll occur. Let's wait and see. We're expecting a result in, on past practice. It'll be December 24th that they release it. So let's review it in January and...
I think the point is that... So don't debate that there's going to be probably more capital allocated to that business. That just kind of reinforces part of our rationale for shrinking our allocation of capital to the business, and making sure that we are deploying our balance sheet really, really wisely to those customers who are prepared to pay for it. And, you know, we've done a really good job, and I think Mark and the team deserve a lot of credit for getting started fast, but there's still a lot more to do on that. We don't doubt that for a second.
So, Andrew Triggs.
We're going around.
Thanks, Jill. Look, just a couple of questions, please. Firstly, on the markets business, we talked in the past about the reliance, or the overly reliance or abnormally high reliance on the balance sheet side of things, which is probably the lowest quality of those three drivers. It looked like in the second half was back at sort of old style levels, so the reliance seemed to be similar to what it has been in the past.
Yeah.
Should we look at that then as second half 15 and first half 16 as just being sort of one time sort of weak numbers? And did you do anything differently to achieve that, or was that literally just... a result of...
So, no, we didn't do anything differently to achieve it. I think the way we run the business is not to assume that we are going to generate those sorts of revenues, right? So I think when we set our resource allocations in terms of targets and returns, we have to assume a much, much lower number from balance sheet. And if we happen to do better, that's great. and that's a kind of an added benefit. But it's we don't run the business targeting that kind of 250 half. I think that would be irresponsible and push unreasonable risk taking. We talked certainly last year about the fact that we had thought that there was going to be a permanent reduction in the revenues coming from balance sheet for a couple of reasons. One, just because of the interest rate cycle that we were in. Well, that's proved to continue a little bit further than we thought. And two, partly because of the, I guess, some of the behaviours in the market due to a bit more scrutiny from regulators and different expectations around that business. We thought there might be more likely to be like the first half in those kind of mid-100s. So I'd look at the second half as being a kind of a pleasant surprise, a good thing. We don't count on it going forward. And Michelle's comments in there were, when we think about markets, it's been a good business for us. We do really, I'm not talking about the balance sheet, we do really well. We're a leader in corporate foreign exchange. We've got a good, you know, this change in the CVA puts us, we're pricing derivatives right up there with the very best global counterparty. So we've got a great business. Sales has held up incredibly well. But we think the business is about right at that $2 billion of revenue. We don't want to push it to be the driver of growth for the institutional or for the group.
Thanks. And the second question, on the customer deposit side of things, deposits in total grew just 1% on last year. And Obviously with the Insto runoff, that gave you good runway to pull deposit rates right down. We've seen that in at least Australian term deposit pricing. As the Insto runoff starts to slow a little bit, Do you think there's a little bit of a headwind from having to get a little bit closer to the pack on what you're offering in terms of deposit rates?
I think that's a potential headwind, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we don't talk about it in here, I guess, enough, but part of the restructuring and rebalancing of the business is to shift our focus much more to be a deposit gathering machine. I mean, I think, you know, we have been too reliant on the asset side for growth and then kind of scrambled around to fund it and et cetera, and that's worked well. I mean, you know, we've done well at it, but it's not sustainable. And part of the refocus of institutional is really to build this cash management business. And again, we didn't talk about it in here, but the cash management business has done remarkably well. I mean, you know, we have managed margins up in that business incredibly well in an environment where interest rates have been falling. And that, so I, you know, we've got a much better platform in cash management today. You know, we're not exactly where we need to be on that. But yes, we need to change. Part of the repositioning is to build institutional in particular into more of a, you know, corporate cash management machine, and the same in the Australia division. You know, we accept that we lag our peers a little bit on that. Part of it's historical, just business mix. You know, we don't have, for example, the government businesses, public sector is generally dominated by two banks, and we don't have part of that to our benefit, and there's a lot of cash in that. But we've got some really interesting plans about how to build our cash gathering capability in Australia, and it's going to be really key. But it's not going to happen overnight.
Just check, we'll go to Brian, then Brett, and then we have some questions on the phone.
Brian Johnson, CLSA. Congratulations, Michelle. Anyone that can get their head around how a bank works so quickly is quite impressive. That said, a few questions.
It's a major uplift.
Major uplift on the last
That's what we know. That's what we know.
There's a long track record of not answering the questions, Michelle, but let's see how we go. Michelle, the first one is, in the pack, you've detailed that you're well-placed to meet the future net stable funding ratio.
Yes.
But you've avoided actually saying what the ratio is. You've just basically sold a very deposit-rich business, and we tend to see all the numbers on a group basis. First question, can you confirm that you are greater than 100% right now? The second one is that we actually... So I'd be interested in what you think the vulnerability on the NSFR means to future deposit pricing, because it's clear that ANZ's term deposit pricing is actually going up again in the market right now. Second leg of that question is, next year's budget for access to the CLF goes down. Could we get a feeling on what those two dynamics basically do to the margin? And then after you answer those ones, I've got a question for Nigel.
Okay. So I'll take NSFR first. I think we do say at the back of the pack somewhere that we're above 105%.
Yes.
And the sale of Retail Asia doesn't change that. In terms of vulnerability to future pricing, I mean, deposit pricing, you know, there has been competition in deposit pricing. The fact that the rest of the system feels okay on NSFR helps a bit, but it's still, you know, I think there'll still be continued pressure in deposit pricing. In terms of the CLF, now I've forgotten what your question
It goes down. The budget next year goes down, which means you've got to hold more bonds, which means your margin goes down.
Yes.
I would have thought. But could you quantify it for us, Michelle?
Maybe Rick.
I'll just give us a few basis points.
So our sea level go down. It's been going down, by the way, since day one, right? It's been going down by about 10% a year, and I think this year is broadly similar. So it'll have a minor impact, but it won't be large.
Is it greater than a basis point on the margin?
I wouldn't even mean that much.
Okay, Nigel. Slide.
To be fair, you would
I'm
put
well.
On notice.
Nigel, slide 72. Oh.
Which you've memorized.
6 months ago, the exposure at default in Asia was $88 billion from memory. And we've heard a lot of stuff today about the rundown, discipline rundown. I see it's now gone, I think, from 88 to 83.
Mm-hmm.
But when you actually have a look in it, things like energy is still sitting at 4%. And if you actually go, and I know that you know some of these things will be scurrilous, but if you go to some of the debt aggregators, ANZ does pop up with quite a few of the single names. Now, I won't detail some of the single names, but it is. Could you just run us through where the risks are in that slide? Where are you seeing pressure?
That makes a change. I thought you were going to ask me about a dairy overlay.
Well, that's obvious. You need one. Everyone in the room knows that.
Well, we know dairy is up 65%. Look, on the energy one, clearly some of the big names in energy, you know, actually are based either in Asia or in Europe and America. So those names end up being, you know, Asia domiciled for what are some of the Australian energy projects as well. So, you know, it makes sense. If you look at the large importers of energy, you've got China, Korea, Japan, all large importers. So it makes sense that they are some of the exposures that we have. You look at a lot of them, they're actually short-term, so they are trade-related exposures as well. I'm actually very comfortable with the energy portfolio there. In the mining piece, we've now had coal prices up 100% since the March 31 date, and I think some of the risks around that are reducing. Those coal prices aren't factored into our provisioning levels in the second half. You know, they're still based on prices from June, July. So that really big ramp up has occurred since then. So I'm actually a little bit more optimistic on a lot of that energy outlook in the second half.
Brett Lemessurier.
Thanks. Brett Lemessurier from Velocity Trade. Question on the Apia institutional business. Your geographic disclosures say that the ROE in that business in the second half was in the range of 2 to 3%, which was down from 2015 and down from the first half of 16 as well. What level do you think you can get that ROE up to? How long will it take?
And also,
given that in the announcement last week you said that 55% of the expenses in the retail business related to cost allocations, can you comment on the cost allocations in that business as well?
Sure. So we don't consider Apia as a business. We don't run a business called Apia. Some revenue and costs happen to sit there. And when you add them up, they produce an ROE. So it's not something that we manage. We manage a global institutional bank, and we manage our retail and commercial businesses. So I think that while the geographic disclosures are meant to be helpful, I'm not sure that they are, to be honest, because actually, as I said, we don't run the business on that basis. What we're looking at is improving return on equity of the global institutional bank. And that, as we talked about before, is heading in the right direction. It's heading in the right direction because we are reducing the capital, and we're going to get more benefit from that, and we're reducing cost at the same time. And we've been able to do that with a fairly small reduction in revenue. And so the return on equity, that is why we are restructuring that business, and that's what will happen. So again, we don't really look at the APIA piece. In terms of the retail and wealth business, you're right. We mentioned that the business that we're selling has 55% or whatever the number was that's sort of allocated. Some of that allocation is... I know this sounds like some of that allocation is kind of direct in nature. It's, you know, it might be operations in Bangalore or Manila that's directly for that business, but it comes through as an allocation. And so that's reasonably easy to identify and remove at the right time. And some of it relates to corporate overhead. And, you know, we have country structures. We have chief risk officers, chief executives. We have people in countries, HR teams and systems that get allocated a little bit to retail. Because the retail business isn't there, those costs don't naturally fall away from the bank. So we have to work hard to streamline middle and back office functions, particularly the middle part, to take those costs out. That is absolutely a big task, and that's what we're focused on doing.
I might add to that just a little bit. So in terms of the business we've sold, the operations people that work directly in that business, a large part of them actually go with the sale as well. It's probably, and I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it'd be north of 70%, I think, of the operations piece. The other categories of costs are there's property. So there's property in Asia that's shared between the institutional business and the retail business. I think, you know, over the next couple of years, we see opportunities to actually get that footprint right. And then the other two buckets are really technology and shared technology. So there's group, but there's also just Asian technology that's shared between the institutional business and the retail business. And then just, as Shane said, the group overheads. So that's why you know, a large part of it we think we can work to get out over the next couple of years. And then there is a remainder that we'll have to think about in the context of the overall simplification of the bank.
So it sounds like the Asian institutional head office allocations is similar to the retail business. Is that fair from what you've been saying?
It depends which of those allocations you're talking about. But are you talking in terms of absolute, not in absolute number, but in terms of percentages?
Yes, relative to the size.
I mean, it's different for different line items, but, you know, broadly.
We have some questions on the phone, so we might move to those, please.
Thank you. The first phone question comes from Matthew Wilson from JCP Investment Partners. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Divesting or downsizing life risk has proven to be a very expensive exercise for shareholders recently. You know, one just has to look at NAB and AMP north of $1 billion. How comfortable are you with your best estimate assumptions that underpin that EV of $5 billion, given the industry structural issues? What level of investment is required to separate the business? And have you attempted to de-risk in the meantime via reinsurance arrangements?
Okay, I'll take those. So in terms of our EV and the assumptions, our EV actually went up about $500 million this year. And our experience relative to our assumptions was pretty good. It was pretty close to spot on, actually. So in terms of things that are happening in the industry, I think they're pretty well incorporated into our EV assumptions. In terms of separation costs, it's probably a bit early to talk about those. That's something we'd talk about when we know what we're doing with the business. I've forgotten the third of the questions.
Have you looked at reinsurance?
Oh, reinsurance. So in terms of reinsurance, we actually are relatively well reinsured in that business. So potentially a little bit, but nothing material.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Andrew Hill from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Two questions, if that's okay. First one just around institutional. If we look at transaction banking, as the risk-weighted assets have come down, the ratio of revenue to risk-weighted assets has rebounded substantially, and it's now sort of above historical peaks. I just wonder, is this sustainable, and can you deliver similar outcomes in the other institutional segments, loans and markets? And the second question was, given it looks like we're pretty close to a Fed rate hike and your balance sheet has changed quite a lot in composition, can you just remind us of the P&L sensitivity to a 25 basis point move in by the Fed?
So the reason that the transaction banking margins, if you will, or the returns have improved so dramatically is really, there's really two aspects there. One is that we have reduced our assets in the trade finance business, and trade finance typically, on you know, as an average, is a lower return asset than most others. And so by just being more selective about that, and you saw that particularly in the first half, that will improve the average margin in the business. And secondly, cash management is in that business. And the cash management is largely has very little kind of risk-weighted assets associated. It's mostly operating risk rather than anything else. That's a terrific return business. And so the more that the weighting shifts towards cash management as opposed to trade, you also get that. We've seen both. And we would expect the trade business is unlikely to shrink anymore. We wouldn't want it. Trade's a great business. It's a great lead product for our customers. It's something we're very, very good at. So we'll manage it responsibly, but we are not asking it to shrink materially from here. But we are absolutely investing for the cash management to grow substantially. So I think, if anything, the returns in that business can actually improve from that reweighting in there. In terms of the,
about 1% is about $100 million, roughly.
For the Fed,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So 25 points is about 25.
Yeah.
Okay, just to go back to that transaction banking commentary, I appreciate you may not get similar performance out of loans and markets, but can you start to see the ratio trend
good.
Those
sorry.
As well?
Yeah, I forgot that part of your question. Good question. So, I mean, let's go back to where we started. Why are we rebalancing our business and institutional? It is about returns. And part of that is the recognition that too much of our loan business is at extremely low return, where we're not getting sufficient cross, where our customers are not paying for our balance sheet, and we're not getting sufficient cross-sell or other product revenues to generate a reasonable relationship return. And so, yes, as we reposition, so we're shrinking those low return institutional loan, the loan book, and we're adding higher return institutional loans where we are getting paid for it. So absolutely we expect the returns in that business to improve. That is essentially why we're doing it. Similarly in markets. So markets are a little bit more complicated because the RWA is not quite as simple in terms of calculation there. But as we grow businesses like foreign exchange, which is core to us, core to our offering, core to our strategic positioning in the marketplace, you should also see returns in that business improve. Probably not to the same extent or the same materiality you've seen in transaction banking. That's always going to be, in many ways, not easy, but that's going to have the most dramatic turn because of the impact of that cash management business on the whole.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. The next question comes from Scott Manning from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I have two questions, please. Firstly, on New Zealand, two parts to that question. The margin's down from 2.55 to 2.35 over the last 18 months. Just some thoughts around the drivers of that, whether it be high deposit competition with some funding changes there, and what the outlook is given the repricing that's taken place through the industry. And secondly, on the impairment charges up in the second half, what's the outlook looking like in terms of how the dairy coverage is looking and the general kind of economic positioning for the provisioning into next year, please?
Okay. So in terms of the margins, yes, you're right. The margins in New Zealand have come down a little bit, or actually a reasonable amount over that period. Some of that's to do because there was some... it's to do with the fact that there's been a mix change, again, increasingly mixed towards fixed rate mortgages. That actually, I think the number went from about 70% to about 74-75% were fixed. And the fixed rate mortgages are lower margin, so that mix change has had quite a material impact on it. And secondly, you're quite right about the deposit competition in that market is, I mean, we've talked about it before, in many ways New Zealand is even more competitive than Australia in some areas, and that's certainly come through as well.
I'd also add there's been competition on the asset side as well. And in addition, just in terms of funding costs in New Zealand, we did an tier one issue out of New Zealand this year as well, which increased funding costs in that business.
Yes. And then in terms of the dairy, do you want to talk about that, Nigel?
Yeah, on the impairments, two parts to the impairments. One, we're coming off very low impairment levels in New Zealand, so we will see some in our sort of commercial institutional book there, so a more normal level of impairments. In terms of dairy, we're very positive on the outlook on our dairy portfolio. Dairy prices now up from the first half, 65%. Clearly that was now starting to flow through to farmers for their payout. We would estimate that over 90% of our farmers would be cash flow positive at these second half prices. And since there's been momentum even over the last few months, those prices have continued to rise. That's going to be a positive for that portfolio. We have not been factoring those higher prices into our provisioning. So you'll see in the slides we've shown the PD on our dairy portfolio. So you can see that we've continued to factor in what have been sort of last year's dairy prices into our provisioning there. So 2017 should be a positive outlook for that.
Thanks. And the second question is actually on capital. So assuming Nigel's assumption of global rules being watered down a little bit are correct, you've got 9.6% Core Tier 1 today. You've got another 20 points from Asia. You've got no more wealth de-gearing to go. You've already rebased the dividend. So relative to peers, that's a reasonable starting point. If you then look from that, you've got $4 billion tied up in Asian partnerships. Assuming that those sales do get completed, how was the thinking on capital initiatives in terms of an adrenaline hit of a buyback versus a great drip feed of DRP neutralisation and deploying it into the business to support growth?
I think we'd love to be having that
nice problem. So I think we feel... look, I think that has been what has been driving a lot of our decisions, right? We recognise that fact that our business model got us in a position where we weren't generating enough capital organically. So putting aside the non-core asset sales. That's been a big chunk of the focus, and we showed you that today that that's changed. It hasn't changed enough. So we're sitting here today in a much stronger capital position than I can recall, certainly relative to our peers. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves and start spending the money. But, you know, if we are successful, and we will be, and we get those things done, we will have a lot more options and available to us than A, we've had in the past, and B, I think, than all of our peer group. That'll be a good position to be in. But we're not focused on what we're going to do then. We're just focused on getting those things done.
I think we have one more on the phone.
Oh, well, I should add one thing. Sorry, Scott, you added a piece here. But by the way, the restructuring we're going through, at the moment, it's easy to focus on, you know, shrinking and selling and cutting back here. Ultimately, we want to unleash the growth that's inherent in our business. We have a great growing business in Australia. We have a great growing business in the best parts of institutional. And those businesses will come through to the fore. We will have growth. But the whole point of the restructuring is to make sure that it is a low capital consuming growth. So no, it will not be we're going to release all this capital, sell some things, and then plough it all back to the good old days of just growing the institutional balance sheet or et cetera, et cetera. No, that's what I mentioned in that phase of kind of trying to learn new habits in the organisation about being really capital efficient and ensuring that is not the intention to plough it back to sort of some, you know, to go back to those old balance sheet driven days.
Thank you. The next question comes from David Spotswood from Shaw and Partners. Please go ahead.
Hello there. Yeah, I mean, obviously, capital is a big issue. I'd just be interested in, as we sit here today, your insights in terms of, you know, Basel IV and APRA, in terms of, you know, whether you're expecting some big imposses to come in FY17. I know it's not clear, but I'd just be interested in your thinking.
Oh, look, we don't sit here expecting some big impost. We know that the trend is that we will be asked to hold higher levels of capital. And that's part of the reason we've been restructuring is to get fit for that and get ready for that, be in a position where we have options. You know, I think that's really important that we do have those options. We do have those levers available. And I think, you know, I feel really good about the fact we're sitting here today, you know, in a much stronger position with more options and still got options available that we haven't used yet. So I think, look, we don't know where that's going to be. All we know is we are well prepared. We're sitting in a really good position here and we still have a lot of options ahead of us. So I'm not going to comment on what we think the impost will be from Basel, because frankly, we don't know.
Okay.
I think...
There's one more, Brian.
All right, one last one, Brian. She says with due trepidation.
Michelle, and all the banks do this, page 99, tax provisions no longer required, $43 million bucks in the second half, 28 in the first half to be 71. Income tax over provided year from the prior year, 23. That's close enough to $100 million, which is a reasonable number. Can we just get a feeling, how big are these unrecognised deferred tax assets? How long should we think that these things keep on happening?
And then the subset of the question, which is totally unrelated, another way of asking another one. Shane, how much of a problem is it that in New Zealand the regulatory capital requirement seems to be going up? So it doesn't impact your level two, but it does impact the level one in Australia. Could you just run us through
so
that?
So I'm going to do what good chief executives do and delegate. I'm going to... So I think, Shane, I don't know if you want to answer the deferred tax question. And Rick, in terms of the reg capital.
I'm tipping the answer might be no.
Sorry?
You go first.
Look, I don't think New Zealand's any different from anywhere else. So the capital requirement continues to go up there as it has been everywhere else. I mean, right now we're able to manage our level one, which I don't think anyone's ever asked about before, but good question. We're able to actually manage our level one at the same rate as level two, and that's obviously controlling the dividend flow we have up from all of our subsidiaries. So as we stand here and going forward, I think we can continue to manage our level one consistent with level two.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Just in terms of the tax provisions, I think we've de-risked our tax strategy, and we recently got 100 out of 100 in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index for our tax strategy. So we've seen some releases. I don't think you'll see this quantum going forward.
Okay.
Okay. With that, I think we'll end the Q&A. Thank you, everybody. And it goes without saying, if you've got questions through the afternoon, the IR team are standing by to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.